Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. Hi, my name is John, and I'm joined with JP. I feel like I need way better intros than I have beyond the one sentence.
No, I think I love how like off the cuff and just sort of organic this is. It's like, hi, I'm John. I'm JP. All right, let's get into it.
Let's just get into some code. Yeah, sounds good. How have you been this week, JP? It's actually been 2 weeks since we recorded, and I apologize for the blip in our release schedule. Things got a little bit crazy for me and JP.
Oh, no, seriously. You know, I think life just happens. My birthday was 2 days ago. I thought I'd just drop that here.
Happy birthday. That's right.
The tax man came and took my monies, so that was always fun. You know, I used to only be overshadowed by tax day, but now I'm also overshadowed by Coachella. So now I have two things going against me for like for the spotlight.
You shine brighter than them all, JP. We know that.
But it was fun. I got dinner at this place called The Black Cat, which is like right here. It's pretty local in Silver Lake. Really good cocktails if anyone is in the east side of Los Angeles that's listening to this podcast, which is maybe unlikely. Black Cat is a really cool spot.
Nice. Awesome. So this week we are still going through refactoring the Martin Fowler book, and I'm loving this thing. I'm getting so much out of it. But this week we're going through chapter 3, and it's a more high level week. So we're not going to be going into specific refactoring examples. It's more of continuing conversations about refactoring in general. This chapter is all about bad smells. So anytime you're looking at something in code and it just doesn't feel right. So it's kind of pulling the thread of when should we refactor? How do we know what should be refactored? Where do we start in refactors? Or, you know, how should we assume something should be refactored? It really comes down to this idea of bad smells. And so we're going to be talking broadly about some types of smells in code. And so it's kind of like talking through, oh yeah, this is a musty smell. This is a poopy smell. And just broadly, what kinds of different smells there are. And what's great about this is it's very broad. So no matter what language or framework you're in, or even like, I realized this would even apply to a lot of like markup situations or CSS situations. A lot of this stuff still applies, which is really cool because oftentimes it only will apply to like Turing complete functional programming or, you know, whatever from that perspective. But this really applies to any time you're trying to get structured information down. And so really everywhere in our code, we can think about a lot of these different smells and they generally will apply and have a lot of good tips and tricks through this whole thing. So I'm excited to dig into these.
Yeah, totally. So this chapter is going to be all about the when, whereas previous chapters have been more about the how to refactor. Which I think is cool. I don't want to bike shed too much, but I think this is where the term code smell like originated from, maybe.
Really?
I think
that's impressive.
I think so. I mean, considering how old this book is, and like, I mean, I don't know, did they invent the term refactoring? Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like it's one of those things that whether or not they invented it, they're the ones who popularized it for sure.
Or like put like a name to it or something.
Yeah, a name to it and kind of got it in the zeitgeist. There's a ton of stuff that comes from basically the Gang of Four, right? It's Martin Fowler, Kent Beck, something Brock. There's like these Gang of Four who wrote all these books. And a lot of what we say and do as programmers is owed to this Gang of Four, to be honest. Like a lot of what we do, which is pretty weird. Like ultimately, it's a huge community, like programming as far as it goes. But compared to other communities and just popular culture in general, we have such a small, tiny slice of pie, which is so interesting. But yeah, so let's get into these things.
I need to make a correction because I definitely have made this same mistake on this podcast before. But Gang of Four is actually about like design patterns. And I think that's...
Oh, that's so gross. I just made the same mistake.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's sort of relevant. I mean, we've talked about design patterns in the past, but Gang of Four is Eric Gamma, Richard Helm, Ralph Johnson. And I'm going to butcher this last name. John Vlacidis. Anyways.
Wait, so is it people or is it design patterns?
No. They are the people, but it is design patterns. But I think we were talking about it in like the wrong context of like of what we were currently talking about.
Okay. So here's my question though, JP. Let's do this. is there a group of four people who wrote a bunch of different programming books known as the Gang of Four, or am I totally insane?
No, that's correct. They wrote that. Okay. They wrote one book though, and it's called Design Patterns.
Oh, got it. And in Design Patterns, there is the Gang of Four.
Yes, they all contributed. All contributed to it, but instead of saying like all four of their like kind of hard to pronounce last names, or they're not that hard to pronounce, people just refer to them as the Gang of Four. I listened to our podcast.
I see that now.
I listened to our podcast, yeah, so, and I made that mistake a handful of times, and I was like, I think I'm wrong about this. So I feel like maybe worth clearing that up.
Yeah, for sure. And this is one of those books that a lot of different books and authors have like come back to. It's like, right, one of those things that's like everyone always comes back to this one, and a lot is inherited from that and spun off from that, and those ideas continue to be iterated in other places. So I understand this. So the full thing is, there's a book called Design Patterns written by four authors, also known as the Gang of Four, and a bunch of stuff. So it's, we were kind of right, we're kind of wrong, but that's interesting.
Yeah. So like in that book, you have things of like the factory pattern and the builder pattern, which, you know, things we've all have talked about in this book. Anyways, that's neither here nor there.
I was looking at my shelf to see if I have that book. I don't. I have Patterns of Enterprise Application Design or something like architecture. That's the one I have on my shelf.
Yeah, I do not have that book either, although I do have like the Ruby version. There's a book called Design Patterns in Ruby, which was heavily inspired by the original Gang of Four book. Who knows? Maybe we'll get into that. Maybe not. It's kind of code intensive.
That was a very big rat hole. I love it. We're good. So we are going to jump into bad smells. So how to find, how to smell, what they smell like, and we're going to start going through these different types of stinkiness in our code. So the first one here is mysterious name. That's the title of it. You want to walk us through that one, JP?
Yeah, mysterious name. I love this one because I feel like no matter who you are, whether you're junior, senior, you know, just starting out in your programming career, you'll always come across this, whether it's something you've done personally or whether it's like code that you're reviewing, or like maybe you're digging into an open source project and you're just like going through what the code under the hood looks like. But mysterious name is exactly what it sounds like. It's an ambiguous name of a variable, of a class, of a function, of, you know, maybe even a database field. Like, what the heck is this type on user? Like, I don't know what that is.
Right. Or what is this column just named token?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Or code. It's like, oh, that's not helpful at all.
Yeah. So when there's a name that you don't understand what it's doing, you know, that is probably an indication that you need to change it. It's funny. I was doing a code review yesterday, and we were basically recreating this UI to be able to like pick something on a scroll wheel. And there was a variable name called item count, which was like 7 or something like that. It was like a constant called item count. And I left a comment that was like, well, what happens if the amount of items passed into this is more than 7? Like, does this thing totally just break? And then the originator of the PR was like, oh, actually, that's not how many items there are. It's just how many are visible, which was like, and then his comment after that was like, I think I'm just going to rename this as like, is probably what the move is. And I was like, cool. That like totally clears things up, because you can see how that might be confusing.
Yeah, totally. So that instead of item count, it's visible item count, or items visible on wheel, or something like that. That's more specific to the instance. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I feel like naming is a place where we don't spend enough time, and you can get so many gains by just finding the right names, all the way down to the right variable within a little JavaScript function that you're writing, all the way up to the right class name or the right kind of module name of how that works. Like, I'm digging into a new software project that's really, really large, and I'm struggling just to find the different kind of verticals or roles within it at a very high level, like from a 10,000 foot view. But I think all the way up and all the way down, naming is something that really behooves us to spend a lot of time on and learn to do really well. And it's only recently that I've found myself doing it better and better. And one of the quick tips I can give is think about things of very specific names, but also things that can be like created, read, updated, destroyed. So what is the noun? So what is the new thing that I'm creating? I'll use this example in a little bit, but I was working on code that is a import. And so there's this idea of importing types of configuration or information from one program, which is like a domain-specific program. So one thing in the application to another thing, like you're importing data from one to another. And the code was feeling very, very clunky. And then until I realized like, oh, well, let's just call this an import, like import.new, and we have an import new screen. And so it's like very clear this thing that you can read, write, update, and destroy, but all the way down to just the right instance variable, make sure it's specific to the thing that you are developing. And just naming is something that is really hard, but it's a learned skill that really pays dividends down the line. Yeah, and bad names. So that's the smell. When it's like, what is this name? That's the smell. It's like, dig into that, pull that thread, try to find the noun behind it and get it to a shared name that everybody goes, ah, all right, I get it now. So this other smell that's here is really easy to see is duplicated code. So, you know, there's this term of dry, don't repeat yourself, keep your code dry, or dryness. And this is a spectrum, as all this stuff is, because there's a place where you're over-optimizing too early and you're never repeating code versus having it repeated in once or two places. Like, that's okay if you're still finding that code. And I'm going to reach all the way back to Sandy Metz's book we talked through, which is basically the third time you write code should be the time you think about extracting it. And that's a general rule I've been using lately, and it has felt really natural and it's felt right, because oftentimes when I'm extracting it for the third time, the sixth time is right around the corner. But there's a ton of places in my code where code's in one or two places, and it's fine. There's no reason to start extracting that out too early, but it really, really helps. And honestly, the simplest way to solve duplicated code is when you have the exact same expressions in like the exact same code within two different methods or functions. And you literally can just extract that out into its own function and then just toss that function within it. A recent example is I was doing this vanilla JavaScript kind of gallery, and there's two types of galleries on this website, like image galleries with light boxes. And for the reason of the context of the project, we weren't really able to use existing libraries. We just wanted to write it in vanilla.js from scratch. We didn't have any frameworks to work in. So we wrote this like nice image gallery that lets you pick and see images in a light box. But there's multiple types of image galleries in the website. And there is one that is a single image gallery. So like you click it and it just opens the image bigger and then you close it. And then there's a multiple image gallery where you click it. And then when you click it, there's multiple thumbnails of that selected image type. So multiple angles of that item. And this had two different JavaScript files. So there was, you know, multi-gallery JavaScript and single gallery JavaScript files. And overall, like I thought that was the right approach to separate those concerns. They were very different things. The way they stored and referenced files was different. However, I realized very quickly that some of the code to show and hide the overall lightbox, it was totally duplicated between the two. So that was something that was literally the exact same code. And so now that's all extracted to a lightbox. So now the gallery uses the lightbox and then is able to use all that duplicated code in one place. So now I can make modifications on that lightbox in a single place, and that is inherited to both of those different image galleries. So this is a really good example of extracting duplicated code using not only extract function to just extract out that exact duplicated code, but then also in a way, it's not inheritance. There's a different word for this, which is extracting it to its own module and then including that module. So I forgot what the exact term for that is. But the idea is kind of pulling it out into a shared usable piece that you're using between two different pieces of code. So that's my two cents on duplicated code for today.
Yeah, that's cool. I like how you mentioned that there's definitely, you definitely have to be pragmatic in your approach of when to finally extract duplicated code into its own method or into its own function. And I think a lot of that just has to do with how painful is it going to be to change this code, right? So, and I do think that the third time is like kind of a nice rule. It's not too hard. On the third time I must refactor this. But there are times where you might have like code in two spots and it's like, it's so minuscule that it doesn't really need its own function. Maybe it does when the time comes, but like, you know, the cost of change is something that you'd have to take into account. That's interesting, because I think this idea of duplicated code goes into one of my picks for this week of a code smell to talk about, this is my segue. It's called divergent change, which I thought was like kind of confusing when I was reading about what it is. But divergent change is basically this. If you look at a module and say, okay, well, I have these three functions. Well, I have to change these three functions every time this happens, every time blank happens. This is an indication of divergent change. So it's sort of like, okay, something with this lightbox needs to be changed. And you're like, crap, okay, I need to change this method. I need to change this method. And I need to change or like this little implementation right here, which I think is interesting because a lot of these things can be solved by breaking things out into their own methods and doing things like extract function and move function and extract class. But yeah, so divergent change occurs when one module is changed in different ways for different reasons. So this whole this idea of a lightbox that you're talking about, I think, is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I feel like I end up in these code bases a lot where making one change somewhere, it's like every time I touch this, I know I have to touch these four other files. And ultimately, they're just leaning on each other too much. And so that's kind of what I got out of divergent change, which I feel like this is identifying a smell, but providing no solution. It's like, great, well, this is a shitty situation to be in, but we're also providing no solution. But that's the thing, and that's what we're talking through is smells here. So if you feel like you're constantly having to edit four files every time you touch one, you're in this code smell. That's something that you should be like, oh, red flags, there's something wrong here. And the bottom line is that everything in your code is too dependent on each other. You need to try to separate these concerns better. That's like the short answer of how to fix that.
Yeah, it's sort of like there's not like one way to get yourself out of this mess, but you should recognize that if you have to edit these four things, something, there might be an abstraction waiting to happen or something needs to change.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the ones I wanted to talk through is long functions. And I wanted to get your kind of opinion, JP, of what your general smell is on how long a function should be in JavaScript specifically. So like when you're looking at a function in JavaScript, how long is too long generally for you?
That's funny. I'm reading your notes here. Yeah. Okay. So the code smell is long function. And we don't have to explain what that is. Everyone knows what that is.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah. It's funny because in our previous books, we've talked about like this sweet spot of like five lines is like a good amount for Ruby. And I think even like RuboCop linters have, I think the default is like five lines or something like that. And I always bump that up to like 10 because I think that like five is like, it's cool. It's in an ideal world, but
yeah. And that's in an ideal world. And I think I land around, I'm okay with a dozen. After a dozen, I'm kind of a hard stop. I'm like, okay, we got to rethink through this and get this cleaned up. But yeah,
with JavaScript.
But obviously, the shorter the better. And Ruby allows you to really extract that really easily and is really eloquent in a lot of ways. And also, like, I don't want to be in this place where I'm using an inline ternary expression just to avoid an extra two lines. Mm-hmm. Like, come on, that's not the point of that. Like, let's live by the spirit of that law, which is like, let's be concise and let's be simple. It's not about trying to cram as much functionality as you can within eight lines. That's not the goal here, people. The goal here is to make your methods and functions do less. That's the overall goal. So for Ruby, I would say my max is kind of a dozen, which is probably pushing it. What about JavaScript? Let's talk about JavaScript functions.
So the thing about JavaScript is oftentimes you'll have long functions because you'll like throw things into a try catch, and that already there itself is like four lines of code, right?
Yeah.
And the thing about the JavaScript community is we all have this very awesome tool that we all love called Prettier, which sometimes adds more lines than you would think because, you know, we have clean line breaks and, you know, you have all these like functions going on. For me, when I'm like, okay, this function is getting too long, is not necessarily based on the lines of code so much as it is like, how many things is this thing doing? Right. So like, if I see a function where I'm like, oh, this is a function that's waiting to happen, this doesn't need to be here, then I'm sort of like, okay, this thing is doing way too much stuff. Let's see what we can do to break this down a little bit. But I don't know if that's like a good answer to your question.
I think that's a really good answer. And I think specifically in JavaScript, a really good way to think about it, it's like, how many things is this function doing? And so like a really quick and dirty example is like in vanilla JS is your function getting the DOM element, reading the data on the DOM element, and then doing the thing with the DOM element all in one function? Maybe like right there, those should be three different distinct activities being delegated to three different functions. Maybe one function that's calling those activities. Like literally it's like, get the element, get the data, set the data. Like something that's like a very, very simple example. But you know, if there's one 35 line function that's doing all three of those things, that function has too many jobs. And that function should either have the job of just calling other functions, which that's all your JavaScript should be doing, or that function should just have a single discrete job, an input and an output to it. So let's talk though conceptually, how many jobs is too many? Like for me as a human being, I can't do more than two things at once. I can wash dishes and listen to a podcast. I can't also try to talk to my wife. Or like I was cooking last night and I was trying to do food prep. And like at the same time, I was trying to cook my quinoa and bake my stuff and chop vegetables. And like it was just too much going on. I was trying to do too much food prep at once. So like at what point is our JavaScript going to burn the quinoa?
Okay. So I was just refactoring actually this component in our mobile app that decides what the CTA should be on a property detail page. So when you go to a property, we have a call to action that basically lets you visit a home. But the thing about this call to action is that it could be like five different things. It could be like a self tour. So like we provide a service where you can unlock a house. You can go up to the house. You could get a code from the app and you can instantly just go in. That's like what Open Door is known for. Mm-hmm. But then not all of our homes are that. So we do provide MLS listings, which you have to schedule through an agent. So it might say unlock now, but it might say schedule tour.
This happens a lot in e-commerce, like in general. It'll say add to cart or add to wait list, like depending on what the status of the item is.
Exactly.
So there's a bunch. This is really, really common in purchase call to actions of handling that state of what that call to action button says.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's basically the gist of it. Other options are like make an offer, or if you have a tour scheduled, it will give you like the tour details.
Like view tour details.
Exactly. Okay, it's like you have a tour scheduled for Tuesday at 9 a.m. or whatever. The logic to display this call to action was in this huge function, and it was basically littered all over the place. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to have to accept that there's going to be a lot of different logic in this, but I need to at least make it so that each of these functions is specific to its sort of own domain, right? Because there's like a chunk of code that needs to exist to decide like whether or not this displays make an offer. And there's another chunk of code that needs to exist that's like, can I unlock this home by myself? And then there's another chunk of code that needs to decide, hey, I need to schedule a tour with an agent. So there's basically like three distinct things. And at one point, these three distinct things were all kind of like, they were just all over the place, right? And then it finally got to a point where it was like, each of these three things had their own if statements, but the conditional for the if was like a bunch of different like and ors. So it was like this crazy, crazy mess. And eventually I was like, okay, these things need to be in their own functions so that I can just read like, if this, do the offer logic, if else, if this, do the self unlock logic, else if this, finally do the like tour with an agent logic. And so like each of those functions, I feel like we're doing multiple things, and I think that's okay because it was specific to its own like little domain of offer, self tour, or tour with agent.
And it was specific to what the higher order function was asking it for.
Right.
Like meaning I know that this house should be saying this, like tell me if it should be saying this and then set that code accordingly to say that. And so this is a good example of trying to give a function a single job. So in a way, you have this higher order function that is saying, okay, all these other small functions, should you be saying this and set that data accordingly? But there's probably a way to extract that even further to be like, okay, what are the different states this button can say? And then there's code within that to say, is it valid in this state? Yes, no, then set the code accordingly. So in a way, it's breaking this one. This could be a crazy long JavaScript function that not only decides whether it can be in this state or not, but then sets that state accordingly. What you can start to do is piece these up into cleaner functions that only really have one job. So there's one job of understanding that's handling and setting that data, and then each nuanced job within it. So you really hedged on my answer when I said how many jobs should a single JavaScript have? But it really sounds like the answer is one. Every JavaScript function should really have one job in an ideal world. And then we should be calling these more and more and more. And I love your point about like, it's a complex concept and you can't expect the code to be four or five lines of simple code because this is a really complicated subject. And it's important to embrace complexity, but also embrace clarity in the complexity, if at all possible. Because oftentimes when you try to abstract this stuff too far, then it's so far from the original problem set. It's this simple, elegant code that's way more complex because it hides all the complexity away. And so it's like you start pulling these threads and you're importing these eight different things. And it's like, oh, this actually doesn't make any sense at all. So in some cases, I feel like there's more clarity in a well-written, well-named 48 or 50-line JavaScript function than a 5-line JavaScript function that's really unclear on what it's doing. It's like at least you can see everything that's going on in one place, and it's kind of delegating all these one or two jobs to each of these functions within it. So there's no clear answer. It depends.
Yeah, I don't know about 40, 50 lines, but I see what you're saying. I get your point. Point noted. I did hedge. I'm like a code politician. I will say, I think one job is the answer. Definitely should be doing one thing. Like you shouldn't have to. One thing I think about when I'm while I'm like writing code or while I'm submitting a PR is I try to think of like the person who's code reviewing my stuff. I'm like, would they have a hard time understanding this? And should I break this into like maybe two functions, or should I break this component into two components, you know, because like, you know, there's value in breaking things down into smaller things, because then you get a chance to name it. And then when you get a chance to put a name on something that used to be like in some hot mess, then you gain clarity out of that, which I think,
Yeah, I think on that subject of getting a chance to name things, there's this idea in a code smell of long parameter lists. And I feel like this happens a lot in both Ruby and JavaScript, but it really happens a lot in JavaScript where, you know, at the top of my JavaScript file, I'm just like setting this big array of data, and then I'm using that array of data through that. And then it's like that same array gets set in different ways across different places. And that's definitely a code smell that I see, which is like you're passing in 5 unnamed params into a Ruby method. And it's like you have to, it depends on order. Depends on if they're all there. And so this is a really good kind of thread to pull when you're trying to refactor. And I think the first one being that's really helpful, it's just like the first step in getting your head around, I feel like, a long param list is just using named params. Mm-hmm. So almost any framework or language you're using allows you to do that, which is like stop and don't let these be ordered params. And I feel like 3 is my limit of where I want to start naming. If it's more than 3, and even that is pushing it, like 1 or 2 should really be the ideal world of having unnamed params. But beyond that, but honestly, just default to named params. Like it's one extra little step to make adds an extra step of clarity into your code. I really strongly recommend in general using named params. But there's this concept too in general of a parameter object instead of a parameter list. And I found a lot of value in this in Ruby in a way, and this is kind of a tangent, but it's form objects and using form objects that delegate to different lower order models or classes and kind of handle that. So abstracting one concept into, let's say, a signup, even though a signup might include information about someone's company and information about a user and information about a user's car, let's say. So there's all these different data points that are being stored. If you abstract that all into a signup class, which is this parameter object, you can have attributes across all three of those models, the person's company, the person as a person, and then the person's car, all within one object that allows you to store that. And so you can have a single form and a single controller in view to those objects without having to try to do all that delegation in your view, without having to do that in other places. And there is this idea of a parameter object that you can throw at a lot of different complex problems, and it adds a lot of simplicity to them. Again, it's finding that noun and trying to combine and bundle up this idea of these params and give those params a name. Like, what are these initial params? And there can be state in some of those param names. So it's like, you know, initial page state could be a parameter object that has the different state of that initial page. And that like gives you a name to that you can share and import and export and use that in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. The thing I like about named parameters is that it makes it very deliberate. And like you reveal the intention that this group of objects that you're passing to this method or to this function are somehow related. And so that gives you like an opportunity to make your domain a little bit more clear. Everything I'm sending to this user method or whatever is like to create a new user, to sign them up, right? So it's like, okay, so that's why like name, email, phone number, and nickname are related, is because like you're using all 4 of those things to create a new user. And I think that's like really cool to be able to like say like, hey, this group of data is like seems random, but when together it's like for a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think there's a code smell in the book that talked about data clumps, which is like, why is this data group together? These should be their own objects. So there's, of course, a spectrum, and it depends. Like, sometimes it doesn't make sense to overly group data when it shouldn't be its own object. Sometimes it makes sense to split them into their own. So there's that same problem that the book talked about. Okay, there's one the book talked about that I feel like went over my head in a way, and I think that I am a bit naive in my computer science knowledge of why this is different. So the one that was talking about is loops, and I understand that it's really bad to use loops in a lot of ways if they're poorly used, but it talks about this idea of a pipeline instead of a loop, and a filter map reduce instead of a for each. Like, so what this example is like, if you need to grab a collection of items, like let's say you want to get a collection of users, every user whose name includes an A. Like, one approach to do that is go for each user, check the user's name, if it has an A, add it to a collection, and then spit out the collection at the end. And honestly, that's probably what I'd reach for in most instances, because I'm not great with like map, filter, reduce. It depends on what I'm doing, obviously. But my instinct, especially if I have to like reach into child objects in Ruby, like let's say I want all users whose car is a model of Toyota, I might use a loop to do that, to find that. Of course, like there's ways to do that and be more efficient. But my question is this, isn't filter and map just an abstraction over loops at the end of the day anyway?
Yes.
So it's the same thing. I don't understand why this is a code smell. I get that it can be ugly, so I want to know your thoughts on this, because it kind of made me grumpy, because map and filter are just abstractions over loop.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, this one seemed kind of just like, well, that's just your opinion. I'm not sure. I don't know why loops are a code smell. Maybe in like modern JavaScript and modern like in modern Ruby, because in Ruby you'd hardly ever actually do a loop. You would never write like for variable I equals one, and then like you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't go through the whole rigmarole of doing that.
That's true.
Same in JavaScript, but the idea of like using pipelines instead is kind of an interesting solution to this, because it's weird that this is even a code smell in my head, because obviously this leans towards like functional programming and chaining things like filter, map, and reduce. I mean, you could literally do anything with reduce that you would do in a for loop.
Right. And I think it's a cleaner approach. And like, I have some code right now that's in production that does things like for each company, go through, then give me each manager in that company. Mm-hmm. And then for each manager, give me each employee and a state on that employee. So there's like three recursive loops going on. This is a terrible way to write the code, and it's a terrible code smell. So I think in general, if you're seeing like a loop within a loop and it's doing multiple database calls, like that's just N plus one is what you're ending up with when you have this kind of recursive loop approach. So I get that generally it's a code smell, but I think just because you're seeing a loop doesn't mean you have a problem in your code is kind of what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this one either. But you know what? Okay. That's the point of discussion. We don't always have to agree with.
Yeah, that's right. So there's this one that I really liked, which is speculative generality. It's like a really funny title for basically putting too much code in now that you think you want to do it in the future. So it's like, oh, I kind of think we want to approach this like this in the future, so we're going to put all this shit in this now so that we can support it for the future.
Yeah, I liked that the indication that you have speculative generality, aka over-optimizing, over-designing, is... Yeah. When the only use case for whatever it is that you're adding is in your tests, right? Mm-hmm. So he says, speculative generality can be spotted when the only users of a function or class are test cases. This is classic premature optimization, which I think is interesting, because it's like, oh, well, we're going to want to add this later on, so we'll write a test case for it. But then it's like you look in the code and it's like, where is this being used? And you're like, oh, well, it's only in the tests. I thought that was interesting. I catch myself doing that sometimes and think like, okay, like when the time comes, I will cross that bridge. But for now, I will design in such a way that it won't be hard to do this. Like the cost of changing this will be very little.
Right.
But I don't want to like litter my code with stuff that's like unnecessary.
Yeah, I did this recently in a code base where we built this messaging tool, and the founder insisted that we build support from day one for group messaging.
Right.
Even though there's no current feature set for group messaging. And so it really added a huge level of complexity to the original build of the messaging tool. And it's like, I don't know where I fall on that, because that is a high level feature that could be really hard to add in the future if you weren't careful about how you structured messaging. Mm-hmm. And so it forced us to create a conversation object that then delegates, like a conversation has many user IDs that have access to that conversation. And that's just two for now. But like in theory, we have the ability to add other users to that conversation object, where otherwise we might not have organized messages in conversations. We might have just said, well, like grab me all the messages between these two users versus like this conversation object. But it's so, it's like, it's hard because as of right now, we're not using that at all. And we have tests that like allow for this functionality to exist. So I think in general, it's a bad thing to do, which is put unused things in your code. It's like building onto your house. It's like, ooh, I might have family visit in 4 years. So I'm going to add 6 bedrooms onto my home. It's like, you're not now. So live in the reality of what is now from a complexity standpoint, and don't like solve that. But it's interesting because I feel like the push on this is often comes from non-technical people on the team. Like they want to make sure that XYZ support is there for when they need it, because I think there's a fear, which is pretty valid, that when they want to build it and when they want to market that feature, it'll take too long to get it in. Mm-hmm. It'll take too long when the time comes, like they won't be able to get it in the code.
Yeah. And the problem with that is like, you're solving problems with group messaging that you might not even need to consider until way right down the line. So you're solving problems that are potentially like totally unrelated to just messaging in general. And so by trying to save time in the future, you're wasting time in the present, which kind of sucks.
Right. Yeah, it's really hard to find the right balance of that for sure. I think in general, don't build before you need it.
Yeah. Should the last one we end off on is, should that be large class?
Yeah, sounds good. Let's attack that one.
Okay, so it's exactly what it sounds like, large class. For this one, I think I do have a rule of thumb for how big my React components are, which are kind of classes in some ways. Not really, they're like function prototypes at the end of the day. But when your class is doing too much, that should be a code smell. For me, when I see a React component that's teetering on 150 lines, I'm like, let's try to bring this down a little bit. Now, obviously, sometimes files can be really long because of like massive amounts of import statements and massive amounts of styling going on. But when I see a React file that's like 300 lines, I'm like, ooh, this is a tough one. I ran across one yesterday that was 740 and I was like, God, this hurts.
Yeah, I think, you know, somewhere for at least in Ruby, I think 100 is big. And if it's over 100, you need to start thinking about what's going on here. And I think ideally it's even smaller than that. But that's kind of my rule of thumb, at least in Ruby. And it's just, again, how many jobs is this doing? You know, is your user class sending a notification? Like, stop that shit. Your user shouldn't be sending a notification. A notification should be sending the notification. You know, those are the types of things. And I feel like in Ruby too, we end up with a lot of these kind of like decorator or helper methods, like formatted phone in a user object. And it's like, this does not belong in a user object. This should be a decorator or a view helper. It's like format phone, pass in the form object, like pass in the actual phone number. And so I think that it's, again, comes back to what jobs is this doing? Are these jobs actually related to the class that it's within? And that probably is a similar thing that happens in React. It's like, this is just tuning to this class is 4 different buttons in this one class. Like, that's what this is. It's like, this should be extracted. Each button should be its own class instead of trying to force this to be do one job. So it's really about breaking up things and making them all do one job, whether it's a method, a function, a class, a model, whatever that looks like. Try to make things do one job as much as possible.
Yeah, cool. So I love that all of this comes with like a caveat, kind of, and it's that, okay, so like we talked about how to refactor and we're talking about when to refactor, but the ultimate answer to when you should refactor is like using your own intuition, mm-hmm. right? Because yeah, it's like, if you see a really long function, it's like, don't just like refactor it because it's too long. You know, mm-hmm. you should be refactoring when things are, when you evaluate the cost of change and when you evaluate like how painful this is going to be, or when you evaluate, is this going to be hard for the person who's reviewing my code to understand, or right, is this going to be hard for future me to understand? So I think at some point you just get better at knowing when to refactor. And it's not just like this formula of, oh, okay, I found one mysterious name here, so I'm going to just like submit a PR for a refactor, right? So it's like, always be pragmatic in your approach. And eventually, with time, you'll understand the times to refactor.
Yep, I love it. Good cover your ass, because there is no hard and fast rule for sure. It depends. Do you have a pick for this week for us?
Yeah, my picks are becoming less and less technical by the episode, but I found this really, really cool shop, like leather shop in the UK, and they make leather fobs for cars. And I found this like really cool classic Porsche crest thing on a fob. And it's really cool because you can buy like official Porsche key fobs, but like the quality is like not that great. It's not like genuine leather.
The real Porsche ones kind of suck. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. They used to be really good back in the day, but I feel like cost to produce these like leather fobs in mass is probably like more expensive than it's worth because people buy anything. But I found this shop called Classic Leather Fobs, and they have like really, really good high quality ones for my car.
Nice. For your car. I love how you're just leaving that is a Porsche. Like you're leaving that kind of unaddressed. That's great. My pick for this week is like I love these kinds of products that are so like first world specific and so tailored to the exact problem that I'm having, which is just ridiculous. Uh-huh. It's called Tooth Fairy. And what it is for AirPod owners to I know exactly. It's the most niche thing. It's for AirPod owners, which is these wireless Apple earbuds, to quickly switch between devices. So like before, I would have to click 3 clicks to switch between my Mac and my phone. And now it's just 1 click. So it's a little menu bar helper that makes it so you can 1 click, like switch your AirPods from your phone to your Mac, which is like very silly. But I do that like 8 times a day when I'm like, you know, doing a video call like this, and then I get a client phone call in a minute. It's like having to like dig into my settings. I was in my settings screens like every day, like 4 times. So now I can just click one button when the phone rings, and then it goes to my Apple phone, which I actually don't know what it's doing. I don't know if it tells my AirPods to switch or if it just disconnects. I actually don't know how it switches it, but it makes it so I just have a toggle on my Mac, which is like, is the output to my Mac or is it to my phone? And it just like lets me do one button click from the menu bar. It's so nice. It's like $2 on the App Store. So if you are a overwhelmed and stressed AirPods owner from digging in your settings menu, you can do it in one click. It's such a silly little tweak, but good little life hack there. So
that's a good
anything
pick.
Else for today?
No, that's a good pick. I just want to say that I like really want AirPods, and I'm like close to buying them. And I asked both of my roommates like a bunch of questions, and that was one of them. I was like, how do I switch between devices? Because I have these Bose QC35s, mm-hmm. and if I want to switch between devices, actually I can have like two connected
right.
at the same time.
I wish
time.
The AirPods did that, because you can connect multiple devices to those headphones right at the same time.
Exactly.
That's so cool.
So I'm on my computer now, but if I get a phone call, I could like literally just answer
it just
works. And it works.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, so this is the way around that, because I think future Apple stuff will probably support more than one device, like in a way that's seamless, like you're describing, because I can pair this to as many as I want, but I can mm-hmm. only have it paired to one device at a time.
At a time, yeah.
So yeah, that's the hack to like fix that and try to get to that like Bose level switching. And AirPods are fine. They're just like the new white earbuds. They just don't sound that great, both mm-hmm. for the listener and for like you talking to people. But they're so just like practical to not be tangled all the time. I love them on my bike because I can hear the world, but I can still like listen to podcasts and stuff. That's not my pick. They're too expensive. Don't buy them. Deal with a cord. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week. And you can visit iterationpodcast.com if you want to learn more about us. Find our respective Twitters and reach out. We love hearing from you guys. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Peace.